Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW, and I want to invite you to become a member of KALW. We are 70% listener supported, so as you listen to this piece from our newsroom, please make sure to go to the Donate Now button at KALW.org. Thanks.
KALW.
Okay, here we are, trail crossing. So I'm going to go ahead and open up our app.
More people are hiking with their smartphones and using apps to navigate.
When they work phenomenally. But if you have somebody that over relies on their cell phone, then it can be very detrimental.
How's technology changing people's experiences in nature? Then a former abuser is trying to stop domestic violence from behind prison walls.
Violence was something that I learned as a young child, being exposed to it. Domestic violence is something that is learned.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is coming up. I have a love-hate relationship with my smartphone. My phone helps me check in on my kids when they're out. It brings me happy news from my family back in Sudan. But it also means getting the bad news, the stressful conversations. And it puts me on this roller coaster of moods and emotional overload. Smartphones are so useful, but so addictive. Sometimes I honestly wish there was a place where there was no phone access. Well, my colleague, KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch, thought she had a place, but it turns out you can't even escape from your smartphone in the woods.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and get on the trail. So we'll unplug everything, and we'll be ready to go in like 5 minutes.
Okay, wait, Noah, can I record the sound of you unplugging things? Because that is the point of the story.
That sound of unplugging.
The guy you hear humoring me is Kevin Mann. I meet him at a rustic resort just outside Mammoth in the Eastern Sierra. This is a popular rest stop for hikers. There's showers, a restaurant, and maybe most crucially, a power outlet.
You just have a rat's nest of wires, everybody charging their stuff.
Kevin's charging his phone, emergency satellite device, and power bank. He unplugs.
Here it comes.
And we hit the trail.
I love hiking.
Kevin's in his 60s and from Richmond, California. He's retired from a career at IBM. Last year, he hiked the entire Pacific Crest Trail from San Diego County to the Canadian border. This year, he's hiking shorter sections.
And that's our bridge.
Today, he and his hiking partner, Lori, are heading north from Mammoth toward Yosemite.
Okay, here we are at a trail crossing. So I'm going to go ahead and open up our app. Here you can see that's where we are. And we need to go to the right.
The app on Kevin's phone has all 2,000 plus miles of the Pacific Crest Trail, plus waypoints for where to get water and where to camp.
So this is like Google Map for hiking. There's your trail.
And then when I click on it, I can open up a detailed description of that spot. So for example, in 4.2 miles, the Middle Fork San Joaquin River, there's a campsite there. Where the trail meets a big river, there's almost always a campsite.
Without these apps, you just hike to where the trail meets the river and hope there was a place to camp. And if there wasn't, you'd look for somewhere else to sleep. But with these apps, you can figure out exactly how far away the next campsite is. You can even read reviews of it from other hikers.
The latest one was a little more than 2 weeks ago. Fire pit, log seating, a river to fall asleep to. I mean, these are just like you would see on Yelp.
This is backpacking in the age of smartphones. Are you ready for the list of technology that people like Kevin are using?
Your smartphone, a charger for when you're in town, GoPro or some fancy other camera, satellite communicator. You have to have a power bank for your electronics, and a fair number of people are carrying solar chargers as well.
And on the smartphone itself, there's a built-in flashlight and compass. And then there's all these apps you can download that have not just maps, but all this irresistible information that's updated daily by hikers.
Like, how much snow is there on that pass? Is that creek or river still running? Is there a log down that you could cross on? Are you going to have to take your shoes off and wade through it? All that information is on the apps, and that's not on maps.
Smartphones are like digital Swiss Army knives, with everything you need to survive in the wilderness in one tool that fits in your pocket.
So this is the things I'm curious about. As a backpacker myself, what I would do when I got to a large creek, because I don't use these apps, I would probably scout one way, scout another. So I guess that's my question is, you know, couldn't you just look around?
Well, it'll take you 15 seconds to look at the app and tell you whether you should go upstream or downstream.
Okay, this to me is where a smartphone differs from a Swiss Army knife. Your Swiss Army knife is a bunch of tools. If you lose it, you can improvise. Find a sharp rock, cut something with your teeth. But losing your phone isn't just losing a tool, because your phone tells you where you are, which way to go, how to safely cross a creek. It kind of thinks for you. I mean, that's why we call them smartphones, right?
Do you have a paper map with you?
No, I don't have any paper maps at all. No, I don't.
What happens if your phone breaks?
My hiking partner also has a phone. We're coming to the bridge.
Oh, and is that where the campsite is that you were thinking about?
We've made it to the campsite by the river that Kevin found on the app this morning. It's a big, flat area that could probably fit about 6 tents. Kevin pulls out his phone again. Because so many hikers are using the same apps, they tend to all get funneled to the same campsites. And Kevin is actually collecting data about this.
So I'm looking at the site, and the first thing we look at is it visible from the PCT?
Kevin is a volunteer for the Pacific Crest Trail Association. It's like a Friends of the Trail group who will share the data with land managers. If a site is too close to a creek or causing hikers to trample a meadow, the group may ask the developers to remove those sites from the app. As for this campsite today?
This looks good.
By now, I'm sure you've realized I'm a little bit biased here. I relish the chance to disconnect from my phone while I'm in the wilderness. But as smartphones become more and more common on the trail, I'm starting to feel like I'm swimming against the tide. Or what would the right metaphor be? Hiking up a landslide? Anyway, Kevin's a generation older than me, but he's way more willing to adapt to new technology than I am.
So I'm 35, and I'm just thinking about how when I'm 63?
63, yeah.
I would bet that anywhere I backpack, I'm probably going to be able to make a phone call.
Wow, yeah, that's not going to be great. I don't know what to say about that. It's pretty hard to resist, and your loved ones want to know how you're doing. They, especially on a longer hike, they want to know all that.
Good morning, go ahead.
We did a reshot. I think we found him.
Copy, I will be in the west side of the meadow. Should be suitable for landing site.
Okay, we'll be down there in six.
Copy all.
About 60 trail miles to the north, the Mono County Search and Rescue Team is preparing to rescue an injured hiker. A CHP helicopter flies in to assist, and a team of volunteers heads out on foot.
Everybody's good. We did a gear check. We're ready to roll.
Let's do it. Rock and roll.
This is Mono County Sheriff Deputy John Pelichowski.
Last night about 10:30, I got a phone call from a lady in the Fresno area about her son being injured somewhere in the area of Peeler Lake.
Just over the northern border of Yosemite.
The interesting thing about it was the way that it was reported. So he's hiking up here alone, and he somehow ended up injured. I believe it's a lower leg injury. And this particular gentleman that injured had no device, no cell phone, no inReach.
An inReach, a satellite device that allows you to send text messages.
So some hikers came across him with an inReach device.
They were able to text their friend in the Bay Area, who in turn texted the guy's mom.
And she in turn called us.
Because so many people now hike with their smartphones and these satellite devices, people can get a hold of John and tell him exactly where the injured person is.
So that kind of takes the search out of search and rescue.
John can learn what happened and how his team should respond. Do they need to bring a stretcher to carry this person out? Do they need to come immediately, even if it's in the dark, or can they wait until morning? Phones and satellite devices connect him directly with the hiker to get all this info.
When they work phenomenally. But if you have somebody that over relies on their cell phone, then it can be very detrimental.
Sometimes people get in over their heads, or they just think they're in over their heads.
We quite frequently get the "I'm tired" phone call, or "I didn't realize how far this was" phone call.
Wow, really though? They'll call and just say, "I'm tired"?
Yeah, they'll call and say that I'm tired, or it's getting dark, or I'm afraid of the bears. And can you come get us? Do you have an emergency? No. Then no. You can walk out the same way you walked in. You know, so it's a delicate phone call. I think people have grown accustomed to being connected to one another, and it's almost a security blanket. I mean, when you're in daily life, right, urban life, whatever you want to call it, and you always have Wi-Fi or cell signal, and everybody you know, everything you need, it's all at your fingertips. And then when you get out into the great wide world, the outdoors, the wilderness, and you look down at your phone and realize you do not have a cell connection, I think it causes a little bit of panic. Go ahead.
We got him. We'll be there in a couple of minutes.
For this hiker today who didn't have a smartphone or satellite device, finding someone who did possibly saved him days of being stuck in the backcountry with an injury. The helicopter airlifts him to the meadow where we are. Paramedics assess his injuries. And this is hard for me to watch. The hiker's fine, but he's definitely shaken up.
I mean, you I hiked 1,500 miles in the High Sierra.
Wow.
I've climbed 15 peaks.
All right, man.
I've never had anything like this.
Hey, that's why we call them accidents. That's why we call them accidents. Things happen.
Okay? I'm glad those guys came across you, though. I'm glad those hikers were able to get some information out. And
From there, paramedics take him in an ambulance to the nearest hospital. He's lucky.
You could have all the cell phone battery in the world and a cell phone connection, and it could be in the middle of a nasty spring storm. And you can call me, but we might not be able to get there. Mother Nature is still in charge. So it's still wilderness. It very much is.
The whole idea of going into the wilderness is to disconnect and get away from our human-centric world. At least that's how it was spelled out in the Wilderness Act.
Hi, my name's Diana Pietrasanta, and I am the Inyo National Forest Public Services Staff Officer.
It's actually part of Diana's job to think about how technology is changing hikers' experience of wilderness.
Well, the Wilderness Act was passed in 1964 and basically gives the ability for Congress to designate areas where man and his influence does not remain.
This is land set aside and protected. No roads, no cars, no houses. The idea is that these are areas where natural processes can occur and humans can visit, but aren't permanent inhabitants. Hikers have this motto, take only pictures, leave only footprints. But this act was created more than 50 years ago, with cars and chainsaws in mind. Lots of new technology has developed since then. Mountain bikes, hang gliders, drones. Land managers like Diana have had to decide whether or not to allow each of these things in the wilderness.
We had this conversation 25 years ago, 30 years ago in the Forest Service, when cell phones first came into existence. And it was literally, is it okay to even have a cell phone in wilderness? That discussion is long gone. Now it's how to manage it. I was up on the PCT just a couple of weekends ago, and everybody's looking at their phone. When everybody's walking along with their head down and their phones in an application, which is basically telling them what they should experience, it turns out to be, to me, a pretty scripted itinerary and a pretty scripted experience.
And an experience that Diana thinks doesn't really match up with the goals that the Wilderness Act promotes. Naturalness, solitude, self-reliance. But then again, getting to go backpacking in the wilderness or just be out in nature is a tremendous privilege. And Diana says there are ways that using a smartphone lowers the barrier to entry and helps get more people outdoors.
It gives them some confidence maybe to go do something they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think exposure to the mountains, to wilderness, that's all good.
This question about whether or not to use smartphones to navigate the wilderness is connected to bigger questions about how we're already letting smartphones change the way we navigate the whole world.
I think that there is a propensity in modern society that you have every single piece of information, and quite a few people have an expectation that everything's just going to go perfectly if they have enough information and somebody else tells them what to do. And that's just not how nature works. In reality, it's actually a pretty good experience to try to get up something and figure out you can't do it. I think it's an experience that should not be missed.
With climate change, there's no place that can escape the impact of human technology, not even wilderness. And now with smartphones, it seems like there's no place where we can truly escape from our technological devices either. I personally will still be out on the trail with my paper map. I'm holding out on the hiking apps, for now. But I will admit, I bought a satellite device so I can call search and rescue in an emergency. I'm a little bit more connected now. And I wonder if it's a slippery slope. In the Sierra Nevada, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is KALW's science reporter. You can reach her at science@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got a story from the Uncuffed team at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
From Solano State Prison,
this is Uncuffed.
Today's story comes from Uncuffed producer Joe Kirk. He spoke to someone who teaches a class in prison for people who've been violent towards their partners and families. And a quick warning, this piece does contain descriptions of violence and abuse.
In my time in prison, I have noticed that a lot of the men around me are incarcerated for some form of domestic violence. Floyd Henley is one of these men. Throughout his stay, he has not only attempted to rehabilitate himself, but has changed the lives of many of the men around him. Domestic violence is something that we rarely used to talk about. What happened behind closed doors stayed behind closed doors. Here is his story.
In the beginning of each of our groups, we have an entrance, and we dedicate each group session to somebody. And I'd like to dedicate this to Sheila Vallon and Steve Phillips, my murder victims. Okay. Violence was something that I learned as a young child, being exposed to it. Domestic violence is something that is learned, and most of the time, it's in the family that it gets picked up. It's passed from generation to generation. I never thought of myself as violent, but the more I read about domestic violence, and I go back and look at my past, I see where I used violence to solve situations. Anytime that there was a problem, violence was a way to do it. But violence was used after we tried the manipulation. A lot of times when I was trying to control Sheila, it was just, I could do it with a look.
Okay.
I could use my voice, tone of voice. And it was all about control. And
could you start to notice the fear in her?
Yes.
Yeah.
I could see where I was able to control. And it was something that I had seen as a child. It's something that had been done to me, so I knew how to do it to the next person.
Did you ever progress to physical violence?
Yes. Slam Sheila against a wall. Hit her. Hit Sheila. Yeah, what you're doing is you're reenacting what was done to you as a child, and you know it worked on you, so you're doing it to the next person.
Now, after you committed these acts, like the aggression and the violence, were you ashamed of yourself afterwards?
Oh, yes. The shame sets in, and that's where you go to the honeymoon stage.
Okay.
Where you promise it'll never happen again. That's when you bring the flowers. That's when you're on your best behavior. The problem is that's just part of the lie.
When did you decide to first get into the domestic violence classes that you're in?
I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know exactly what. Okay. And then I started taking psychology classes and started to learn that this was a conditioned response from my childhood, that I had watched it in both sides of my family, my grandparents. I had extremely abusive grandfathers. I had abusive parents. And I saw the arguments, and I saw violence. And it started to really get on me that that had actually crept into my relationships as an adult. Even though I knew it was wrong and I detested it, but it still came in. And I wanted that out of my life. And the only way to do it was, I found out, was to go back, and I had to deal with the past.
You guys are in dorm 6. Dorm 6 is kind of the dorm the groups are held in.
Yeah.
It has paintings on the wall.
It's got paintings. It's got murals on the wall. It's about 10 to 12 feet deep and about 24 feet wide.
Okay.
And we'll have, like I said, a whiteboard behind us. It's got our agenda for the day and what we're talking about.
Okay.
And we'll start off, one person will read out his homework.
Okay.
Whatever the subject was that day. And then sometimes we have questions, sometimes it's feedback, and sometimes it's just support. And it's really kind of liberating to see that men actually, when they get to the root of their problem, they become more relaxed. You can actually see it in their face sometimes, how relaxed they get. The group that I facilitate now, I'm the only one left of the original group. Everybody else has paroled, and it's amazing that so far none of them have come back. Yeah, we're doing good there.
That's the other thing I've noticed about your group is that in prison you get a lot of people are nosy, and when a lifer comes back from the board, you find out whether they got a found suitable or not. And a lot of guys that are in here that I've seen for domestic violence that haven't taken your class or haven't taken a class like yours, the board's always, no. But every guy that's taken your class, the board's like, okay, like, we're going to let him go.
Yeah.
Good job. It's doing good.
We've had a real good success rate. This is a long-term group. Most of the people that are being found suitable have been in it 2, 3, 4 years. And that's a lot of exposure. And the other thing is, they're helping new members that show up.
Yeah.
And, it goes right back to that AA thing that addict can best understand another addict. And they've been there, they've been at the bottom, and they're trying to come back.
After doing this story, I did a lot of thinking. Even though it is my opinion that Floyd has changed, there's still one thing we cannot forget about. This story is about Sheila. We can't forget about her or the senseless violence that other people like her have endured. If you know someone that is in a situation like this, do something, because you never know if it'll be your last chance.
That was Joe Kirk speaking with Floyd Henley. Kirk is a producer in KALW's radio program at Solano State Prison. Our work there is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer, and the producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. The prison could not provide statistics on who attended the class, how many left prison, and whether any have returned. And you can hear more stories like this by searching for Uncuffed on your podcast player.